Somewhere in the world right now, morning is breaking. Every living thing wakes. At this very moment, someone is greeting a new day. Or maybe it's their first day.
From dust I rise and out of nothing awake. These brighter regions which salute mine eyes. A gift from God I take. The earth, the seas, the light, the day, the skies. The sun and stars are.
These lines were written in 17th century England by Thomas Traherne. In a series of poems, Traherne blends a fully formed mind with the body of a newborn infant to imagine the sensation of seeing the world around us with new eyes, beginning this very morning. The earth, the seas, the light, the day, the skies, the sun and stars are mine if those I prize. Imagine if this is the first day, the morning of your life. How would the sky appear to you? And the sun, he asks. In a 17th century lesson in mindfulness, the poet tells us to look again, to begin again, to greet this morning as if it were unknown to us because, in fact, every morning really is.
From dust I rise and out of nothing I awake. These brighter regions which salute mine eyes. A gift from God I take. The earth, the seas, the light, the day, the skies. The sun and stars are mine, if those I prize.
The text is one of a few that the group Landless has put to song, especially for this series. They sing about love, death, and the end of the world. Good songs to fill our mornings, noons, and nights. And we're all wide awake now, aren't we?
I had a dream. I was following a barefoot girl beside a stream that flowed around the world. We spoke of many things. There were mouths never moved as the most peculiar scenes were disappearing into view. Oh, what a dream.
In the Dream Song, Joan Baez describes a crazy dream, a type of technicolor nightmare. Of barefoot girls and halls of mirrors, which at the end leaves the singer suspended between dream and reality.
It's just a dream. One of those that goes on and on, scene after scene, with the rhythm of a gypsy song. When I really woke, I was frozen in between. Didn't know who I was, it was a dream inside a dream. It's just a dream. It's all a dream.
It's morning. Dream fragments hover over us from the night. They can, as the song says, leave us frozen in between the world of sleep and waking. We've opened our eyes, but have the dreams from the night before actually vanished? Where have they gone? This is a question I asked the psychotherapist, Rachel Keough.
Dreams are really important because they're almost like the language of the unconscious. They're telling us something that we don't know yet. we might not be sure why we feel certain ways about certain people or about certain situations, but often our dreams will show us this. So if we can pay attention to our unconscious, it often has really good information for how we're living and how we're feeling in everyday life. You can keep a notepad beside your bed and jot down things if you wake up. But in the morning, when you wake up, often there's a bit of a dream left there, and your feelings will tell you that. But if you pay enough attention to that, usually more information will come. But what usually happens is we go, oh, that wasn't much of a dream, forget about that, and it's gone.
When I wake up in the morning, like a lot of people, I probably go to my phone very first thing while I'm still with one eye closed. And I get the sense that that's not really an ideal practice.
It's probably not an ideal practice because we switch straight into our day mode then. If we can get into the practice of whether we meditate or pause in the morning for a few minutes before we get out of bed, before we start rushing, usually we can stay with some of the feelings or some of the images from dreams that we've had that night before. They might have a chance to come back up.
Why do you think some people can't remember their dreams?
I think it's to do with how in contact with ourselves we really are. You know, some people work in a very practical sense. It's very much, what am I doing today? A very practical relationship with the world. And they mightn't have an openness to even thinking about dreams. They might just think dreams are just, you know, a memory of what's happened that day. So I think their belief about dreams or their lack of belief about the significance of them might mean that they don't remember them. So when you wake in the morning, if you can get into the habit of just lying in the bed and keeping your eyes closed and tuning into your body, you know, noticing how it feels to lie in your bed, noticing the sounds around you, noticing how you feel as you're lying there, and really gently checking in with yourself, you know, asking yourself, can I remember anything from the night before? And notice what you're feeling, actually, is the main thing when you wake up, because the feelings are often left over from a dream. So a lot of the time we feel our feelings in our belly or in our chest, in that area of our body. So if you can sense into your belly and even put your hand on your belly and notice how you feel and think about, you know, what dream could I have had last night? What's left with me from last night? That could be really useful.
Thomas Kinsella's poem Mirror in February is a story, if you like, of a man in his 30s who's woken up in his old bedroom at his family home. He's shaving in the room in front of a mirror, and he's conscious at the age of 33 that he's leaving his youth behind him. This was one of two poems by Kinsella, which are at the very end of a poetry book we had in school in the 90s called Soundings. My partner, Kevin, and I have a copy in our house, and we've often spoken about the impact that Thomas Kinsella had on us when we were at school. I asked Kevin to read the poem to me.
Mirror in February by Thomas Kinsella. The day dawns with scent of must and rain, of opened soil, dark trees, dry bedroom air. Under the fading lamp, half-dressed, my brain idling on some compulsive fantasy, I towel my shaven jaw and stop and stare, riveted by a dark, exhausted eye, a dry, downturning mouth. It seems again that it is time to learn in this untiring, crumbling place of growth to which, for the time being, I return. Now, plainly, in the mirror of my soul, I read that I have looked my last on youth and little more, for they are not made whole that reach the age of Christ. Below my window, the awakening trees, hacked clean for better bearing, stand defaced, suffering their brute necessities. And how should the flesh not quail that span for span is mutilated more? In slow distaste, I fold my towel with what grace I can, not young and not renewable, but man. when we read it in class, it reminded me of my dad, or memories of seeing my father shaving in front of the mirror. And I think at that age, maybe you think about your relationship as a man with your father. It is very plain speaking and very serious.
You loved Emily Dickinson.
I did, yeah. I mean, that's plain speaking, but very odd. Whereas this speaks to a more everyday experience, particularly in the winter, you know, getting up for school and it being cold, and that experience of seeing yourself first thing in the morning in a mirror.
And on that as well, when you were reading it, I had a thought for the very first time. And it was, when we experienced this poem, it might have been in fifth year or sixth year of school, we were probably starting to shave ourselves.
Yeah, that's true. And being uncertain about it and what it meant about masculinity and what it meant about getting older and growing up and leaving things behind and entering a new world. Which the poem coming at the end of the volume as well means that you're leaving the book. And this would have been one of the last things I think we would have read before the exams. And there's a sense of departure or coming out of something and into something new, which was also the experience of being in your final years of school.
I still have the picture in my head of that room. From when I first encountered the poem at school. It's the same room in my mind.
It's so clearly beside a window and above trees and under a fading lamp, and the scent of rain outside and the open soil outside and things like that. It seems that everything of experience and memory is being focused in the single experience of shaving and looking at himself in the mirror.
Like, obviously before those, you had, in this book, you had Kavanagh, you had Yeats, you had, I think maybe Austin Clark, I'm not sure. But there was just something about the Kinsella, though, that spoke to me in a different voice. It had a different voice.
It does, yeah. I mean, the others seem maybe a little more self-consciously poetic or something that they... But this one just feels like somebody is saying something to you. It doesn't really feel like a poem, though it's very beautifully put together. It just feels like an observation. To me, that's the difference.
In Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, Jonathan Harker has spent a sleepless night, his first night at Dracula's castle. In the very early morning, he stands before a mirror, shaving, and probably is looking at his own dark, exhausted eyes like the man in Kinsella's poem. It's not yet dawn. The sun certainly can't have risen because his host, the Count, makes an appearance, but strangely not in the mirror.
Jonathan Harker's diary, May 8th. I only slept a few hours when I went to bed, and feeling that I could not sleep anymore, got up. I had hung my shaving glass by the window and was just beginning to shave. Suddenly, I felt a hand on my shoulder and heard the Count's voice saying to me, "Good morning." I started, for it amazed me that I had not seen him, since the reflection of the glass covered the whole room behind me. In starting, I had cut myself slightly, but did not notice it at the moment. I turned to the glass again to see how I had been mistaken. This time there could be no error, for the man was close to me, and I could see him over my shoulder. But there was no reflection of him in the mirror. The whole room behind me was displayed, but there was no sign of a man in it except myself. This was startling, and coming on top of so many strange things was beginning to increase that vague feeling of uneasiness which I always have when the Count is near. But at the instant I saw that the cut had bled a little, and the blood was trickling over my chin, I laid down the razor, turning as I did so half round to look for some sticking plaster. When the Count saw my face, his eyes blazed with a sort of demonic fury, and he suddenly made a grab at my throat. I drew away, and his hand touched the string of beads which held the crucifix. It made an instant change in him, for the fury passed so quickly that I could hardly believe that it was ever there. "Take care," he said. "Take care how you cut yourself. It is more dangerous than you think in this country." Then seizing the shaving glass, he went on, "And this is the wretched thing that has done the mischief. It is a foul bauble of man's vanity. Away with it." And opening the heavy window, with one wrench of his terrible hand, he flung out the glass, which was shattered into a thousand pieces on the stones of the courtyard far below. Then he withdrew without a word. When I went into the dining room, breakfast was prepared, but I could not find the Count anywhere. So I breakfasted alone. It is strange that as yet I have not seen the Count eat or drink. He must be a very peculiar man.
Every house we have a shrine in it. So we've had shrines, well, since I became a Buddhist, really. I'm Pavra, and I work at the Dublin Buddhist Centre, and I mainly teach yoga there.
I'm Niana Dara, and I work at the Dublin Buddhist Centre, and I mainly teach classes and courses on Buddhism and meditation.
Pavra and Niana Dara are practising Buddhists, and they're also two friends of mine. They invite me to their house early one morning. Every day, before breakfast, they spend a couple of hours chanting, meditating, and doing yoga. This is done in front of a shrine in the corner of their room. If someone hasn't ever seen a Buddhist shrine before, then Pavra, what are they looking at?
Well, you'd be looking at an image or a statue of the Buddha, at least a candle, a bowl for incense, and a vase for a flower.
There's also a theme going on, I've noticed, of skulls. So there's lots of skulls around. There's a very large one here made of tin. Is it tin or gold?
It's definitely not gold. That was bought on Liffey Street in the pound shop.
What's it?
Well, it was a fiver. But anyway, but it's made of ceramic.
So what is the significance of the skulls then?
On a very basic level, impermanence. And just to remind you that life is short, make the best of life. And when you're practicing, practice fully, be present, give your heart to your practice, give your heart to your life. In a way, the shrine is just a reminder.
So you're just simply aware of your breathing.
Extend the knuckles away from the shoulders. Turn the big toes in slowly. Group the outer knees in slowly. Back of the neck long, your face soft. Change the interlock of the fingers and then extend your legs.
It's movement, rhythm, sensations that arise with the breathing.
Make your legs compact. Feel the collarbones broadening outwards from the center to the side of your back ribs lifting as the knuckles extend back away from the shoulders.
Just whatever is of most interest about your breathing and deepening your attention.
So as a morning task, if you like, meditation and yoga, how does it set you up for the day in the way that a bowl of porridge would set you up? I mean, what does it bring to your day?
Well, it just reminds you of, in a way, the heart of what it means to exist as a human being and the potential a human has to have a mind and a heart free from greed, hatred and delusion. And that's represented by the Buddha, who was a human being who freed his mind and his heart. And he said that other people can do that if they put his teaching and his Dharma into practice. So we invoke that through the chanting, through the sitting quietly, and then through just exploring what it means to have a physical human body through the yoga practice.
What a lot of Buddhist practice would centre around is some quite fundamental principles, like trying to live in a way that's of benefit to others rather than harmful to others, trying to live in a way that's generous rather than selfish, trying to live in a way that's trying to develop contentment rather than greed, trying to develop a way of life which is expressive of something that's true rather than just producing more falsehood and lies, and trying to be more aware in what you do. So those sort of five principles of kindness, generosity, contentment, truthfulness, and awareness would be really, really fundamental. And, you know, most Buddhists around the world could recognise those principles of being, you know, of worth practising and worth trying to bring into being.
Do you want to tell me how it was that you became interested in Buddhism and acquainted with it?
I was really into debate poets and fascinated by Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs, and just finding out how influenced they were by Buddhism. And through exploring particularly Allen Ginsberg's poetry and Allen Ginsberg's life, I just became fascinated with the Buddha Dharma and realised that it spoke to me very clearly and very deeply. And at that time, I was desperately seeking a deeper meaning in my life and a deeper connection with other people who are putting something profound into practice and exploring it through talking about it, through sitting, through going on retreats, etc. Just trying to figure out, why am I alive? What does it mean to be alive? And what does it mean to live life fully?
You hear about what happens in the world, and there's just awful stuff all the time happening, people getting murders, and what's my response to this? So, you know, at least I'm going to try not to let hatred arise in my mind. I've not got any aptitude to kind of be a world leader or anything like that, or even a local leader, but at least I can, you know, have a positive influence in my immediate environment.
I think people just should live their life as fully as they can in whichever way that they find speaks to their heart. So maybe it's Christianity, maybe it's poetry, maybe it's art, maybe it's cars, but whatever you do, just live fully. Do it if it's your last day. And ideally, I try to live in that way too. And in a way, the essential thing is kindness. Just be kind to yourself, to the world, to your friends.
Light by Rabindranath Tagore. Light, my light, the world-filling light, the eye-kissing light, heart-sweetening light. Ah, the light dances, my darling, at the center of my life. The light strikes, my darling, the chords of my love. The sky opens, the wind runs wild, laughter passes over the earth. The butterflies spread their sails on the sea of light. Lilies and jasmines surge up on the crest of the waves of light. The light is shattered into gold on every cloud, my darling, and it scatters gems in profusion. Mirth spreads from leaf to leaf, my darling, and gladness without measure. The heaven's river has drowned its banks, and the flood of joy is abroad.
Sky, wind, laughter, butterflies, leaves. The morning seems full of air and flight. And in a radio program which is looking at our various experiences of the morning, we should also consider how some mornings sound. I recorded this little bird early one morning last May on the outskirts of a town. You can hear traffic competing with the dawn chorus. What strikes me about the wren song is its precision. Each burst is delivered with the regularity of a heartbeat. The sound is penetrating. If you manage to see the round bird singing, you'll notice its tail cocked defiantly and the air filling its minute body as it assaults the morning. Surely it exhausts the bird, and yet the battery continues long after I've moved away. The wren will deliver 4 to 5 of these trilling phrases per minute. Its song can be heard half a mile away, and the wren is bound to know this. It's listening carefully between each outburst for a response from a rival or perhaps a mate. Let's consider the might of the tiny wren as we listen to it in full throttle.
The Wren by John Clare. Why is the cuckoo's melody preferred and nightingale's rich song so fondly praised in poets' rhymes? Is there no other bird of nature's minstrelsy that oft hath raised one's heart to ecstasy and mirth as well? I judge not how another's taste is caught. With mine, there's other birds that bear the bell whose song hath crowds of happy memories brought. Such the wood robin singing in the dell, and little wren that many a time hath sought shelter from showers in huts where I did dwell in early spring, the tenant of the plain, tending my sheep. And still they come to tell the happy stories of the past again.
Like a flea, I'm going to hop from one bird to the next, from a wren in a hawthorn tree to a starling on a dustbin lid.
Let us go then exploring by Virginia Woolf. Let us go then exploring the summer morning when all are adoring the plum blossom and the bee. And humming and hawing, let us ask of the starling what he may think on the brink of the dustbin whence he picks among the sticks combings of scullion's hair. What's life, we ask? Life, 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 cries the bird, as if he had heard.
These lines written by Virginia Woolf are a delight, but what can they mean? Life cries the bird as if he had heard. Heard what? And why are there combings of scullion's hair on the bin? Let our morning, this morning, be filled with mysteries. I thought when I first read these lines, if only we could greet each day with that affirmation of the starling, crying life, life, life. It could be sung just for the pure joy of it.
Let us go then exploring this summer morning.
As Landless sang there, let us go then exploring. Let's. Morning seems a ripe time for exploration. There's the promise of some new experience, a fresh adventure.
Paris is a magnificent and charming spectacle, and especially at that day, viewed from the top of the towers of Notre Dame in the fresh light of a summer dawn. The day might have been in July. The sky was perfectly serene. The sun was about to appear. Paris was beginning to move.
Climax of his novel, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the writer Victor Hugo follows Quasimodo to the northern tower of the cathedral. Things are going to get chaotic and the day will darken, but Hugo clears a little space for us to spend a moment to look out across the city on a bright summer's morning.
Giant shadow of the towers leaped from roof to roof, from one end of the great city to the other. Voices and noises were to be heard from several quarters in the town. Here, the stroke of a bell. There, the stroke of a hammer. Beyond, the clatter of a cart in motion. All sorts of indistinct sounds floated over this half-awake city. Above the towers, high in the sky, twittered the cheerful voices of early birds.
In her poem, Notre Dame, the poet Kerry O'Brien is also mesmerized by the cathedral in the morning. Kerry spent some weeks in Paris when she was in her mid-20s, and she told me that she visited Notre Dame Cathedral first thing in the morning at least 16 times.
So I've ended up living in Paris a few times. That's always for about, the first time was about 6 weeks. And that was in January of 2012. And it was just snowy, proper winter time. I was about to turn 25. And at that time of the year, because it was so snowy, there were no queues for Notre Dame. I was living in the fifth, so I was about 10 minutes walk from it. So I thought, it was Paris in the snow, it was art galleries, it was coffee, do it when you're 24. So I'm not a morning person. I'm actually not, which is great. It's funny. Like when I actually managed to do it and see a sunrise or actually get up and get out, like I adore mornings. I think they're so magical, and it is this kind of, it's kind of like you're reborn, there's something just so beautiful. But at the time, I think I was quite good at getting up early because of the daylight issue. It's deep winter and it's freezing outside. And like that, I liked kind of the idea of having this big cathedral kind of to myself, which you would. I studied art history in Trinity, so I've always been quite into cathedrals and architecture. But in the chancel bit behind the altar, there's this amazing bit, I took photographs of it, where there was a big, beautiful stone floor and the light would come in at this certain angle through the stained glass windows. Because churches, the altars always face east. And because the sun rises in the east in the morning, you get these stunning reflections all over the floor, which you wouldn't get later on. And you'd always just have this hushed, big, massive place to yourself. Notre Dame. Certain mornings, I would be the only one to see the first streams of it, tumbling through stained glass, smattering everything, red, gold, rose, blue, the beauty almost frightening. Eve Klein would daub his women blue and hurl them at the canvas. Living brushes, haphazard and outrageous. Same effect, different every day, this glittering cave. Big, beautiful, lit up thing. It knew and knew why I had come. Falling like water, blue, gold, rose, red. My river walk, my morning prayer. I would step into it slow, circling the altar, gold cross flickering in the center, anchored, rooted, still. As above, so below, eyes closed, filling my heart with the warmth of it, until my body was sunlight and roses, and the fear fell away in petals. Would you believe it if I told you nothing felt separate?
Were you surprised that people responded to it so well when the cathedral burnt down?
Yeah, it's one of those strange moments where I suppose I never, ever envisaged Notre Dame. You just, something like that, you never think it can be damaged or it'll go or there's even a slight chance of it disappearing, And because I'd spent so much time there over the years and it obviously does mean so much to me. A lot of people read the poem, Notre Dame burnt down, and so many people kind of connected to it, that sense of there's something sacred about it. And I suppose in a sense, the idea of a cathedral is that you're in the presence of God, really. But I do think with Notre Dame, like I'm sure you saw on Sky News and everything, people kind of kneeling and praying and crying in the streets, you know, and people of all ages. I think that is a testament to the power and just the stunning, the stunning atmosphere of this really beautiful building, which I always think is kind of the heart of Paris. Yeah, it's just, it's heartbreaking.
You mentioned fear. Can you read the last line of the poem or the last lines where you mention fear at the end? That's interesting.
Filling my heart with the warmth of it until my body was sunlight and roses and the fear fell away in petals.
Is there a specific fear that you have in mind here, or is it the fear of a lot of 24-year-olds when they're living abroad?
Definitely when you're 24, that anxiety of I've gone abroad on my own, what am I doing? I did come back to Ireland after that, but I didn't know at the time. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. Am I going to stay in Paris? And I'd left my job and I'd left everything and made this big leap. So I think a lot of it was that kind of uncertainty. I think a lot of it probably was like depression, really, you know, not realizing it. In hindsight, like, you know, there had been massive heartbreaks and a lot had gone on. So I think Paris is a very healing place for me. You know, it still is. So I think a lot of it was just kind of, yeah, a lot of emotional things tied up in that. And I suppose there is this kind of, maybe it's like some sort of absolutionism thing that you're in this cathedral space and you feel this, you know, like for me, it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be some sort of Christ-like connection at the time, but there has to be something there, you know, kind of the Catholic past, you know. But I remember this kind of feeling of, you know, being a bit lost and being very broke and being like, what am I doing? But in the mornings, just having that sense of just beauty and safety and it just being genuinely illuminating.
Ready, boys? Tom, mate, was drunk and he went below to take a swing at his bottle of.
So early in the morning, the sailor likes his bottle of.
The bottle of, the bottle of, the sailor loves his bottle of.
So early in the morning, the sailor likes his bottle of.
A bottle of rum, a bottle of gin, a bottle of Irish whiskey, oh.
So early in the morning.
Herman Melville's novel Redburn was published some years before his great epic Moby Dick. It's the story of a teenager, Willoughby Redburn, who sails from New York to Liverpool on his first sea voyage. Redburn's innocence is slowly eroded by the harsh life at sea and by the grinding poverty which he finds in Liverpool. The seeds of Moby Dick are in the novel, in particular the empathy that the writer expresses for the marginalised. These include a group of Irish emigrants who boarded the ship, the Highlander, in Liverpool to join the return sailing to America. One morning, after 3 days at sea, land is sighted. But it's not the land of the emigrants' dreams.
After the first miserable weather we experienced at sea, we had intervals of foul and fair. Mostly the former, however, attended with headwinds, till at last, after a 3 days' fog and rain, the sun rose cheerily one morning and showed us Cape Clear. Thank heaven we were out of the weather emphatically called channel weather, and the last we should see of the Eastern Hemisphere was now in plain sight, and all the rest was broad ocean. Land ho! Was cried, as the dark purple headland grew out of the north. At the cry, the Irish emigrants came rushing up the hatchway, thinking America itself was at hand. "Where is it?" cried one of them, running out a little way onto the bowsprit. "Is that it?" "Aye. It doesn't look much like old Ireland, does it?" said Jackson. "Not a bit, honey. And how long before we get there? Tonight?" Nothing could exceed the disappointment and grief of the emigrants when they were at last informed that the land to the north was their own native island, which, after leaving 3 or 4 weeks previous in a steamboat for Liverpool, was now close to them again, and that after newly voyaging so many days from the Mersey, the Highlander was only bringing them in view of the original home whence they started. They were the most simple people I'd ever seen. They seemed to have no adequate idea of distances, and to them, America must have seemed as a place just over a river. Every morning, some of them came on deck to see how much nearer we were, and one old man would stand for hours together, looking straight off from the bows, as if he expected to see New York City every minute, when perhaps we were yet 2,000 miles distant, and steering, moreover, against a headwind. The only thing that ever diverted this poor old man from his earnest search for land was the occasional appearance of porpoises under the bows, when he would cry out at the top of his voice, "Look, look, ye divils, look at the great pigs of the sea!"
Here's another view of Cape Clear Island, this time from the land. Oh, look, now you have the view. Cape looks so close, doesn't it?
It does. Roaring Water Bay and Kilcaw Castle, where Jeremy Irons lives there.
Mizenhead.
Yeah.
And the lovely smell of hay.
That's a lovely hay field. We wouldn't have looked sideways at those.
No. What is it, 3.5 miles to school?
3.5 miles.
I'm in Lachine, a parish a few miles west of Skibbereen in County Cork. I'm with my mother, Eileen, and she's taking me on her old route to school. 3.5 miles across fields from their old home place in Ardoch, along the country roads to the national school, which is still there. We're walking fast, wearing our showerproof jackets, and we're going to school 1950 style.
So I suppose this first part of the road was the most boring because we were just, it was just us, Pat, Anthony, Jerry, Corny. He was a lot older, so. And then there was one man with his pony and cart going to the creamery every day with his churns. And if he had room, he'd give so many of us a lift. But if he had no room at all, he'd say the same thing every single day. He'll be early enough, though.
I suppose you would have loved a lift.
Oh, God, yes. We really wouldn't have chosen to walk. We didn't know any different, so we never complained about it, but getting a lift was a real treat. And if you were lucky enough to get one in a pony and trap, which would be rare for weekdays, they were usually kept for Sunday mass. But that was a big treat.
It's a long walk, so what about the rain?
Yeah, we hated the rain, obviously. But, I mean, we had raincoats and we kept wrapped up as best we could. So we got a lot of wettings, and when we go home, we just changed everything, and Mama would have dry clothes aired for us over the stove or over the range. We got into our warm clothes and she'd have something nice and warm for us. Maybe an egg custard out of the oven or something to keep us going until our evening tea. But you're coming up now to my childhood dancing place. The open-air pattern, that's this side of Minahans.
This is just a gate and a garden.
But that's all it was. There was a platform inside here. It's all overgrown now, of course. But there was just a platform and a musician sitting at the end of it. And all the locals that wanted to come dancing came dancing. I used to love it because it was one of the first places I was allowed to go as a teenager. While Dada went next door to the pub for a beer. And the only downside for me was I used to have to walk home with him afterwards.
Why was that a downside?
Well, of course it was a downside because I'd be watching fellas to walk home with.
So this was the Lachine pattern?
The Lachine pattern. Sometimes they'd have afternoon dances as well, but night time, Sunday night from 7 o'clock on, they were beautiful, they were lovely.
Do you remember any of the people you danced with?
I do. I can remember dancing with Tim Joe. I would have been a fairly good dancer. He was probably fairly average. And the music changed from the waltz we were doing to a quick step, and I couldn't think for a minute what it was. So I said, Tim Joe, it's changed, what's this? And he said, we don't know, fate, bye, but we'll hop away. So I suppose we did hop away.
We're looking at a landmark, so over there I can see Minahan's pub.
Minahan's pub, indeed.
This would have been Grandad's local pub, so it's a good stretch from the house.
Oh, yes, yeah. But they would come here on their way home from the creamery on the odd occasion. If they were coming from a fair or something like that and they'd sold cattle. But I remember Mama used to dread Christmas Eve because you'd see the ponies and cars tied up here till maybe 6 o'clock in the evening. They used to come in and have a bit of a booze up.
Finally, we can see the school.
Finally, we can see the school. The funny thing is, when I get to this part of road, I always feel a tiny little panic because I think I used to always worry at this spot about being late and start running.
Would you have attended a lot of days, or would you have missed a lot of days?
No, we didn't miss many days. We weren't really allowed to miss days unless we were genuinely sick. Our attendance at school would have been very good.
Well, do you know how we're going to prove that?
How?
We're going to have a look at your register to see exactly how many days you did attend that school in 1953.
When are you going to see it?
They're waiting for us.
Oh, stop, Rick. They're not.
There.
Oh, my God. Now I definitely won't remember anything.
What do you have to remember? Your two times tables?
I'm Katrina O'Driscoll, principal of Lishi National School.
So, Katrina, will you just tell me what you've pulled out of the shelf there?
I've pulled out Lishi National School register book, so it would have the details of... There was one for the girls and one for the boys. If we look at... You see, we are up here. Eileen Iragon. Eileen Iragon. Yeah. Date of admission, 1937, junior infants.
Yes, I suppose, yeah.
You were born in 1945, you clown. How could you have gone into school in 1937?
Oh, yeah. This would be Mrs. McCarthy's classroom. Had you Mrs. McCarthy?
I did indeed.
This was Mrs. McCarthy's classroom. And the fireplace was here.
And I can actually picture. This hasn't really changed.
No. So this would have been the junior, seniors, first and second.
Yeah. I'm sure I used to sit over there somewhere.
What I wanted to ask you, while we're standing by this bricked up fireplace here, yeah, would there have been a fire?
Oh, there would have been a fire, yeah. Well, we used to pick the kippins the evening before and we'd dry them at home in front of our own stove. We took it in turns from the classes to bring them. Dad had wrapped them in newspaper and tied them with a bit of string, and we'd bring them and give them to the teacher and start up the fire. And then somebody kept it going for the day. And then about, I think it was about 12 o'clock, we put all the bottles around the fire.
Bottles of milk.
Milk and cocoa mainly. Some people brought tea maybe, but they were all around the fireplace, all around the fender. And when you saw them bubbling, excitement, that was time to break up and go.
Now there'd be people who would never know what a kippin is, I'm sure.
What a kippin is, just a kindling.
So this room is quite large. Is it the same as you'd remember it?
Oh, I absolutely remember it as is. And I can remember her sitting up here at her desk by the fire. Yeah.
I was going to say, so the classes turned its back on the fire, but in those days, would she have had the best seat in the house?
She'd have had the best seat in the house, definitely. Yeah.
Right by where we're standing.
Right by where we're standing.
Backside up against the fire.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, she would indeed.
Coming to the end of this first episode of Morning, Noon and Night. Next week, we'll saunter across an afternoon.
The beasts of the field take rest after their feed, and the rabbit will scarce peep out of her burrow.
It's a time of fulfillment and reflection.
As writers, we have good writing days and bad writing days. And by 2 o'clock, everything hasn't gone to pieces yet. It's still redeemable.
A time of loneliness and joy.
You can spot a botanist from about a quarter of a mile away. They're usually looking at their feet. But after a busy week, don't you feel like the worries of the week are just melting away?
Once again, we'll have readings, short features and music to help us make sense of it. Thanks to all the contributors to this episode, to Rachel Keogh, Kevin Donovan, Pavara and Nyanadara, Kerry O'Brien, Eileen Hutchins and Katrina O'Driscoll. And to the readers Yvonne Cullen and David O'Mara. And thanks to Landless, who've brought some curious verse to song, especially for this series. Before we leave the morning, however, let's consider one great morning yet to come. That morning when we shall all rise from our monumental beds.
Behold, with awful pomp, the judge prepares to come. The archangel sounds the dreadful trump and wakes the general doom. There'll be no snooze buttons for that morning of the general doom. Landless sang these words on their album Bleaching Bones. Here's Doomsday. See you next week. Maybe.
Behold, with awful pomp, the judge prepares to come.
Dark angels and a dreadful
dark angels and ring the general drum.
Landless performing Doomsday from their album Bleaching Bones, ending that first episode in the series Morning, Noon and Night. Morning was presented and produced for RTÉ Lyric FM by Regan Hutchins. The entire series is available to podcast from RTÉ Podcasts and from the usual podcast providers. Search for the Lyric Feature Podcast. We welcome your comments by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.